Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The real question in this trade and currency war in which we find ourselves is actually pretty simple. Who's going to blink first? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. Tuesday, today, the 6th of August. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Currency, again and still, is the byword in the U.S.-China trade relationship, I guess you'd say, today. Specifically, the fallout from Beijing's decision over the weekend to let its currency fall in value against the dollar. The Treasury Department has, as you might have heard, decided that that makes China a currency manipulator. That's a big, big no-no in global trade with lots of not good potential fallout. So we got Meg Lunsager on the phone from the Wilson Center in Washington, and we asked her whether China is actually manipulating its currency.
No.
Oh, why do you say that?
It's not currency manipulation because they're not driving the currency down intentionally for unfair competitive advantage. They're basically following the market.
Fact is, and as we know, facts matter, China has been propping up its currency for years, fighting the market on the downside. So if this isn't currency manipulation, what does Ms. Lunsager think the White House is talking about?
The president's just using it as a way of trying to get back at them, I presume, on trade and get them to the table to make a deal. Now, unfortunately, I think he's really making it more difficult for the Chinese to make a deal because it'll look like they're caving to the United States.
And here's why this is a big deal. Even though they do seem to have taken a pause today, if China does keep letting its currency drop in value against the dollar, thus making its exports to this country cheaper in the face of tariffs, that could be motivation enough to make the president tariff things even more. And you can see how that just becomes a spiral, hence the question being, who's going to blink first? Less well noticed in the trade war that has now become a currency war was this item: China's Commerce Ministry suspending its purchases of American agriculture, all American agriculture. That was our cue to call Brian Duncan. He is the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, also a hog, soy, and corn farmer in his own right. Good to talk to you again, sir.
Hey, good to talk to you, Kai. I always enjoy it.
Thank you very much. Me too. I want to do a very quick drive-by on the trade situation just because you're kind of one of our go-tos on that. It seems to have pegged up a notch here. The president's talking about how good he's being to farmers. But in the meantime, there's a currency war now. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, you brought up a couple issues. We've talked several times about this in the past, and we keep hoping for better news than what we're getting, right? You know, farmers are receiving another round of tariff aid payments, which we're grateful for, but it will not come close to making us whole. And especially as we look at this long term, right, the damage just continues to mount.
Right. Okay, on to other topics. The real reason we wanted to get you on the phone was a piece I saw, I think, in Bloomberg the other day about the weather and how hot it is and how your hogs are getting skinnier because it's so hot and that's pushing prices up. Is that really happening?
Well, it's maybe not quite that simple, but yes, that does happen. Hot weather slows the growth of hogs, even though we keep them in, you know, really nice environmentally controlled buildings. The heat we can't do much about, and they don't gain as fast. And that did happen in July. We saw some marketings back up and some marketing slow. But Kai, those pigs come to town eventually.
I guess they do. Where are you selling them these days? I mean, we used to do big pork business with China, not to bring that up again, but now we don't so much. Where's your market?
Oh, man. You know, and you bring up China, and it's like a knife in my heart tremendous potential there, Kai, especially with the massive losses they've suffered in their hog herd. due to African swine fever. Yeah. So domestically, we consume a lot. We are moving some product back to Mexico. Hmm. We are at a 10-year low on product into Japan because we find ourselves at a disadvantage with the countries that joined Japan in TPP. Wow. And I guess that's another knife in my heart that we've talked about in the past.
And I didn't even bring that one up. You did it to yourself.
No, I know. This trade thing, Kai, it's just like circular bad news, isn't it? So we've, again, seen with the flare and the Chinese problem, the hog market reacted almost immediately because there are still hopes for us to move some product into the Chinese market. But that's about all it is right now is hope.
I have to tell you, I think it's really interesting that you still have hope because all the indicators, and you got to have hope and yes to all of that, but all the indicators are that this is only getting more spiraling downward instead of positive.
No, you're right. Yeah, you're right. What do you want me to do? Quit? But then who are you going to call when you need to talk about hogs,
right.
Kai? I've got to stay in business, and I'm doing it just for you. But still the reality is we've got a growing world population, and they need to eat. And at some point, we hope cooler heads prevail, and we can get some deals done. But you are right, Kai. I think in the countryside, the volume of hope that farmers had has definitely gone down over the last year and a half as we've watched events unfold.
I'm going to let you get off the phone, Mr. Duncan, and I'm going to point out I didn't even bring up corn and soybeans here. So, you know, there's that.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Kai. Let's talk about that another day.
Yeah, we'll give you a call in a while. Brian Duncan, hog farmer, corn guy, soybeans, also the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mr. Duncan, we'll talk to you soon, sir.
Always a pleasure.
Speaking of hope, here's what happened on Wall Street the past 48 hours. Monday, as you know, China decided to let its currency drop. So too did stocks, 3+%. Today, China decided not to let its currency drop, and traders said, oh, everything's fine. Seems not well thought through. I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We interrupt our regularly scheduled coverage of the Federal Reserve now, all interest rates all the time, of course, for an item a bit more tangible. The Fed is building something called a real-time payment system that would let users move money in real time, that is, instantly between bank accounts. The Fed is not the first mover here. Big banks have been working on a real-time system for years, but Marketplace's Justin Ho reports the Fed can still make a difference.
When it comes to launching an entirely new product, like an instant payment system, Seth Carpenter at UBS says the Fed has a big advantage.
They don't have to necessarily make the business pitch to outside investors. They can just decide to do it and fund it themselves.
He says the Fed's been processing and clearing payments for decades. And because the Fed is independent, Myrod Rodriguez Valladares at MRV Associates says the Fed can take its time rolling the system out.
That allows them to spend a lot more time really trying to work out the kinks in terms of systems, in terms of data collection.
The Fed said instant payment systems help people access their money immediately and avoid overdraft fees. They also help small businesses pay their suppliers faster. But there's already a rival instant payment system run by the Clearinghouse, which is owned by several big banks.
What this is really being driven by are the small and medium-sized banks who just don't want to play ball with the larger banks.
That's Ron Shevlin at Cornerstone Advisors. Still, he says those banks won't be able to offer instant payment services for a while because the Fed's new system won't be available until 2023 at the earliest.
This isn't going to help the smaller banks gain any market share or provide any new services for a minimum of 4 to 5 years at the least.
In the long run, Fed Governor Lael Brainard says the country's payment system stands to benefit from the added competition. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
California likes to boast that it leads the country on environmental and green policy issues. So it was big news that one of the biggest recycling companies in this state has shut down all of its 284 locations. Replanet had set up at grocery stores so people could bring their cans and bottles and get their 5 or 10 cent deposits back. But it turns out the recycling business model is hurting in part because China is not buying our stuff anymore. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Scott Tong.
When Replanet shut down and laid off 750 workers, it jolted California's recycling industry. Jenna Abbott heads a statewide group of recycling centers known as Protect CRV.
When the shock wore off, it was replaced by anger because we saw this coming, and Replanet wasn't the first to fail, and it very likely won't be the last.
The market has changed. For years, America's junk was China's treasure. Chinese recycling companies paid good money for our used plastic and paper. But last year, Beijing started rejecting waste it deemed contaminated. Here's environmental scholar Kate O'Neill at Cal Berkeley.
China took around half of the plastic that we put into recycling bins. And once they stopped, local authorities and recycling companies went from making a profit to having to pay to get rid of this stuff.
Some of the most affected, she says, are those in poverty who turn in recyclables for money. Adina Renee Adler of the Institute for Scrap Recycling Industries, however, says there is still demand for what we throw out. She says it's important to find profitable second lives for, say, soda bottles made of what's called PET plastic.
My husband and I both own a number of shirts that we wear every day. They're woven by fibers that originated as a PET water bottle.
Demand needs to catch up with supply. And every year, Americans supply some 80 million tons of recyclable waste. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, sometimes it's a case of them finding the snacks. Sometimes it's a case of the snacks finding them.
How big tech does snacks? But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, here you go. Dow Industrial's got some back today. 311 points to the good, 1.2%, 26,029. The NASDAQ found 107 points, 1.3%, 7833. The S&P 500 up 37, 1.3% there as well, 28,081. So, ag. In honor of Mr. Duncan, how about that? Food processing giant Archer Daniels Midland tumbled 0.9% today. The chemical firm Bayer, which has a big ag division, hello Monsanto, lost 0.5%. But farm equipment maker John Deere rose 1.1% today. Bonds rose just a touch. Yield on the 10-year T-note stayed pretty much where it was, 1.71%. See also inverted yield curve. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Toni Morrison died last night, an iconic American writer with more accolades than we can fit into this program. The Pulitzer Prize, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Nobel Prize in Literature. All for her decades of novels and essays and stories revealing some of the nuances of Black life in America and the sometimes harsh truths of America itself. Morrison is being rightly remembered today as an author, but as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, Toni Morrison had a profound effect on the publishing industry as well.
Toni Morrison was the first African-American woman editor at publisher Random House. That was back in the 1960s.
When she was an editor, among the best-selling books by Black writers were books that regarded Black people as essentially exotic anomalies.
Errol MacDonald is a vice president at the division of Random House that published most of Morrison's novels. MacDonald says, as an editor, Morrison pushed for Black people to be represented with dignity.
And she published some major books by writers such as Muhammad Ali, Angela Davis, Huey P. Newton, books of relevance and of moment that opened the doors for many a writer of color.
Morrison also taught many burgeoning writers, including Jean Jarrett, who now teaches African-American literary history at New York University. When he was getting ready to go to graduate school,
she agreed to write me a letter of recommendation, and so if it weren't for her, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Jarrett is now head of the School of Arts and Science at NYU. He says Morrison inspired an entire generation and laid the groundwork for Black writers, especially women, to have a greater profile in the literary world. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Late last year, the Monday after Thanksgiving, General Motors announced it was going to take 5 plants offline and lay off 15% of its salaried workforce because, the company said, it has to meet car buyers where they are. More SUVs and light trucks, fewer sedans, get going on electrics and self-driving. The catch is that those shutdowns left workers without jobs where they are. GM says there is work for most every hourly employee at one of its other plants, provided they're willing to relocate. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson spent some time talking to GM employees in Lordstown, Ohio, where, until it went dark this past March, GM had had a plant since 1966. The question on a lot of the kitchen tables was stay or go.
For the Fegley family, moving isn't all bad.
I cannot wait for this house to go away. It is the most decrepit piece of crap in the world.
Melissa Fegley points to a missing patch of ceiling above the dining table in her house in Warren, Ohio, just north of Youngstown. It's one of a long list of things she and her husband haven't had the money or time to fix. The house needs a new roof, a new foundation.
The original piping is bad and it leaks. We fixed it so many times and it still leaks.
It's the shower.
That's Melissa's 11-year-old daughter, Serenity.
I'm not going to miss the house. Or they get out of the shower.
Yeah, because of the water leaking.
Yeah. I hate that so much.
You won't have that anymore.
Melissa's husband, Lincoln, has worked at GM's Lordstown, Ohio plant since 2008, except for a 16-month layoff soon after he started. He was one of the last 1,600 employees at the plant this spring when GM discontinued the Chevy Cruze and mothballed the plant. Many of those workers have asked to transfer to other GM plants, what's known as a voluntary transfer. But other workers, including Lincoln, have been assigned to new plants by the company, what they call a forced transfer. GM is sending Lincoln to a plant that makes vans and mid-sized trucks in Wentzville, Missouri, near St. Louis, a 10-hour drive from friends and family. And that's weighing on Melissa.
Because 10 hours isn't something I can just zip home if somebody's like, oh, mom's in the hospital or so-and-so, this has happened.
The Fegley's family and friends gathered at Lincoln's favorite barbecue place to say goodbye before he headed to Missouri in April.
That was the most crying I've ever seen out of a group of adult men. They will all deny, I'm sure, if anybody asks them later.
Yeah, I'm saying goodbye. I want everyone to take note of it.
At the party, Lincoln was feeling pretty emotional about the move, but he also felt like he didn't really have a choice. He could have turned down the transfer, but then he'd have lost the unemployment benefits from the company, including health insurance. He'd lose the right to transfer to another GM plant. So moving was the best of not great options.
Yes, because where else can you go and make this kind of money?
Working on the assembly line is draining, repetitive work. But Lincoln makes almost $30 an hour.
I mean, sure, it's costing me my body and damages, but maybe my daughter won't have to go through any of this with me working and being able to put her into school and through school.
So he's upset with GM for closing the plant, thinks it's corporate greed at work, but it still pays better than any other job he could find.
Around here, the best stuff is $16 an hour and a half for my house. Anything else is $9 to $11, and that doesn't cut it. When I was working that before I started at GM, my credit card just kept getting fuller and fuller just trying to make it.
Under GM's union agreement, Lincoln is getting $30,000 for relocation expenses. But in exchange, he's committed to stay in Missouri at least 3 years, even if the Lordstown plant goes back to work. That's at least 3 years away from everyone the Fegleys care about, like Joshua Fegley, Lincoln's brother.
He's been my, it's been my rock basically my entire life. And yeah, GM is kind of taking him away from me.
And Joshua's losing more than his brother.
I have a lot of friends who work for GM. A lot of them are in Tennessee and Indiana now. And every day on my way to work, I see another house is up for sale. And I feel like this is because of GM.
He's worried about how the plant closing will affect business at the restaurant where he works and what will happen to the area's economy if the plant doesn't reopen. Lordstown isn't quite the GM company town that it once was, but if the plant doesn't open, researchers estimate the direct and indirect costs will amount to an $8 billion hit to the regional economy. Like her uncle, Serenity isn't feeling much love for GM right now either, and she's figured out who she thinks is to blame. It's CEO Mary Barra.
It's crazy because a single person, CEO, should not have the right to just make us leave every single thing that we've ever known
loved ever experienced behind because she thinks that it's not worth it or it's not going big enough. And it's stupid and it's crappy and she should not have the right to do that.
Still, the Fegleys are trying to think of the move as a fresh start. After the party, Melissa and Serenity stayed in Ohio to finish out the school year. Lincoln started work in Missouri in April and made an offer on a new house a month later. He used the money from his GM relocation package as a down payment, something he and Melissa had trouble saving for on their own. Melissa remembers when she saw the new house for the first time in June.
Yeah, I cried because I was like, I don't know how I'm going to keep up a house this nice or how I'm going to keep it clean. And this one, like, everything works and all the windows close and there's no water leaking from everywhere. So it's amazing and overwhelming.
It has two stories, four bedrooms, a garage. Serenity gets her own bathroom and it's in a quiet neighborhood. She won't fall asleep to the sound of sirens or stereos blaring. The house had only been on the market 2 days. Already had another offer on it, and they had to pay just over asking price to get it, $226,000.
Yeah, it makes me a little nauseous. That's a lot of money.
Their old house in Ohio was once appraised at $60,000, and it was fully paid off. But because of all of the repairs it needs, the couple is selling it to Lincoln's brother for only a few thousand dollars. So the new house is much nicer, but it's also totally changing their financial picture. And that feels risky.
It's a contract year for the UAW, which means there's always the possibility that there's a strike, which if there's a strike, he's not making any money. I don't want to get out there and dig ourselves into a hole that we can't get out of.
In some ways, the plant closing helped the Fegleys do something they've wanted to do for years, find a better house in a better neighborhood. It's just not the town or even the state they wanted to be in. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've got more about how other workers from GM and its suppliers are figuring out what comes next. Marketplace.org is where you can find it. So there you are, mid-morning or perhaps mid-afternoon, depending on your rhythm. You need a quick something to eat, off you go to the vending machine. There are, of course, some companies that provide snacks gratis, but no company more so than Google. And snacks doesn't quite do that company's food options justice. Talib Visram wrote about this for Fast Company. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So it's not new, right, that high-tech companies in Silicon Valley have snacks in the office. But Google, you say, has taken it beyond, shall we say.
Exactly. Well, Google seems to be the sort of mothership. They sort of were one of the originators of the snack game at tech companies. And, you know, they have 70-ish campuses across the world and 1,300 of what they call micro kitchens. So, you know, across these 70 campuses, they have these little kitchenettes where they have coffees and teas and then these sort of cornucopia of snacks.
And the gist of it is that they go to great lengths, Google does, to curate, I guess would be the word, what their employees get, right?
Sure. Well, it's worth noting that because Google's such a big company, you know, there's an extremely complex team structure at Google Food. There's menu architects and wellness managers and nutrition specialists. But they all work together to curate the snack menu. And, you know, sometimes it's a case of them finding the snacks. Sometimes it's a case of the snacks finding them. You know, I talked to a couple of companies who effectively lobbied their way into Google, and they said it was tough. There was a lot of vetting. It took a lot of time to get in. And you're asking Google what they wanted. What did they want out of snacks?
Are there Google employee taste tests to figure out what gets into the snack bar, as it were?
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting parts, these sort of snack fairs. So they're kind of mini trade shows, and these shortlisted snack companies are invited in to, you know, chat to employees, and the employees taste the snacks and then they vote. You know, according to the campus, they could vote via QR code or via Google Doc, which is quite apt.
Of course.
The food team will sort of give priority to their most healthy snacks. Uh-huh. Someone said that, you know, even if no one votes for bananas, there'll still be bananas.
That's right. All right, wait. On the healthy thing, I want you to tell me about the pork rind guy, because A, I love pork rinds, but B, they're not the healthiest thing in the world, right?
Right. So it surprised me that these pork rinds or chicharrones, which they call pork clouds,
yeah.
are only 100 calories per pack and they're gluten free, which is surprising given that they're, you know, they're the skin really? Of the pig that are sort okay. of fluffed right. in olive oil.
Yeah.
yeah. but my reaction. Exactly.
Yeah. But the guy, basically, the thing is with this vendor, getting into Google for him was sort of like getting into like Walmart or Costco, right? It's a big, big business opportunity.
It really is. And that's one of the things that these companies said was, you know, not just financially, but just symbolically, the significance of being, you know, of having Google as a client is priceless. You know, it being able to include it in their marketing materials. They really say, while it's hard to measure, you know, it's likely that it brings a sort of ripple effect into mm-hmm. bringing new business in.
Tal Avisram at Fast Company. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, hat tip to Bloomberg for this one, a peer-reviewed research paper entitled Analysts and Managers' Use of Humor on Public Earnings Conference Calls. Now, if you've ever listened to an earnings call, a barrel of laughs, they are not. But quoting from the abstract of this paper, analysts, that is Wall Street Bank analysts, who use humor on conference calls are allowed to speak for a longer period of time and receive longer responses from managers. When managers use humor, the paper goes on, analysts' stock recommendation revisions following the call are more positive. Our findings indicate, finally, that humor has economically meaningful implications for public earnings conference calls, which I thought was fascinating. All right, we got to go up on Wall Street today. Got back about a third of what it lost yesterday. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Stephen Bion, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.